the vanguard of Western ideals and the heritage that you and I cherish can do a better job of satisfying the urgent human needs of these peoples and developing states, ensure at least a compatibility of policy, if not a convergence of policy, between them and ourselves, and above all, that we can manage more effectively the turmoil and the conditions that generate turmoil, which make it such a fertile ground for external fishing expeditions. In that context, I think the growth of terrorism worldwide is a matter of increasing urgency for Western powers to address. I think international economic and energy problems are of fundamental importance. Now, this is just a not certainly all conclusive list, but I think these are among the most urgent. And I must add that I give a special priority to our own hemisphere and the Caribbean and Central American scene, which is so close to us and so vitally important in its outcome, and which will influence our relationships with Mexico for a very long time to come, to say nothing of our other Latin American friends.
Looking back over the past decade, the decade of the 70s, do you perceive any change in the nature of the threats to the security of the United States?
Yes. And some very fundamental ones. They are not all bad, some are good. Some add to the risks and the diciness of the course. But in terms of our own interests, they may make it somewhat easier if we handle it properly to achieve those interests. I talked about the emergence of multipolarity, the move from a bipolar world to a multipolar world, and with special focus on the differences between Moscow and Peking, and the opportunities and dangers and risks that that poses for us. I talked about the very fundamental shift in the military balance that I spoke of in my formal opening statement. And we talk about a changing, developing world where human aspirations and relative changes in power balances and raw material requirements. Western industrialized societies were spawned in an environment where raw materials were relatively available and cheap. We found fundamental changes in the last decade as raw material prices escalate, especially energy. And the impact that that's had on Western industrialized societies is profound. And we're going to have to deal with it. We're going to have to deal with it urgently and effectively.
Well, I think this last point that you raise is one that is a concern that I share. The events that we first observed in the period 73-74, the years of the Arab oil embargo, which signaled to the world as well as to ourselves that for the first time since the colonial period, the United States was vulnerable because of a lack of resources, a lack of material resources. We began to depend on other people for things vital to our survival, to our economic welfare, to the security of the nation. And do you think that that condition does, in fact, present a threat to the security of the United States?
Yes, I think it not only poses a threat to us, but in a broader sense poses a threat to world peace as a new set of vital essentials for all powers have become increasingly important.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Mathias. Senator Saunders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Haig, I never met you until this morning, and I called someone to ask what you were like. He said to me that you were remarkably capable, bright, and tough. And I think your performance today bears that out. I think your record, which I've had a chance to look at, is very commendable and many areas, including especially NATO. I think what you did there was something that you should be very proud of. that it is the nature of these hearings, as you know, to focus on areas where you and I may disagree. And that's what I'd like to pursue with you. And I do that because I think you will be the Secretary of State, and in proper time. And in this nuclear age, the fact is that the fate of my children rests in your hands. And when you look across the table at someone who controls the lives of your children, you take it very seriously. And I'm dedicated to that process of inquiry, and you are no stranger to dedication yourself, and I'm sure you understand that. Let's talk about Afghanistan, if we might, and I will get into the issues that I discussed with Mr. Califano on the phone 2 weeks ago, and which you and I discussed briefly on the phone yesterday. You said that we should have taken a stronger stand when the Soviets tried to instill a puppet regime in Afghanistan, so I take it you think it was wrong for them to do that.
Yes, I do.
And why was that?
I think it was represented a fundamental clash to our national interests, Senator. I believe the upsetting of a long-standing international posture for Afghanistan, which was achieved almost a century ago, primarily by the United Kingdom, represented an ominous departure from previous post-World War II Soviet activity, not just in the context of the employment of force there, but more importantly in the context of their willingness to directly dabble in a rather high-profiled way in such an area.
Well, I agree. I don't think the Soviets have any business changing governments around the world. Let's talk about Chile.
Yes.
In 1970. First of all, now that Senator Helms has arrived, for my own edification, Senator Helms stated that the women of Chile asked that Allende be brought down, and you said that's right, you have spoken with them. Who were these women?
Well, Senator, I had the opportunity in Brussels some years ago to speak to one of the leaders of the women's uprising in Santiago. She recounted a story to me which I thought had tremendous credibility from my own ability to recall intelligence reports at the time. And it ran something like this. You know, the Chilean military had a very strong anti-interventionist bias, unlike many of the other Latin military attitudes. And a very small percentage vote, because of the split of the moderates in Chile, resulted in the ultimate incumbency of Allende. The women of Santiago watched first the importation of masses of Cuban-printed textbooks into their schools. They watched the imposition of teachers who had to adhere to Marxist-Leninist philosophic lines. And during that period, according to my reporter, this woman that you asked about, the women of Chile were profoundly disturbed. And they went to their husbands, many of whom were in the military at that time, to try to urge them to take action to prevent the communization of Chile.
Well, when was this?
This was during the early, well, I would say the second year of the Allende regime. She also recounted that finally the women banded together and operated to stop the flow of commerce, food, and fresh agricultural products into the city. They lay down and became human barriers. And she then described that at that time the Marxist government seized the women and threw them into jail, truncheoning some of them. This is the description you've asked me who described this. And it was at that time that the Chilean military rose up and by forceful action change the government. Now, I don't know whether this represents a precise articulation of fact, but that, along with my own recollections and professional access to intelligence, has a great deal of credibility with me.
There's also a reference made to the communists that Allende was associated with. Who are those people? You said that was true. Can you indicate who those people were?
I'm sorry, I don't...
Senator Helms referred to communists that were associated with Allende, and you said that was true, and can you...
I hope what he asked me, because that's the question I thought I was answered, were there Marxists introduced into the country? There were increased levels of Soviet presence in Chile, increased levels of Cuban presence in Chile, to be specific. And then I suppose you could go into a number of other variations from Eastern Europe, which may or may not have any importance in our discussion.
Let me say that your capacity to recall that conversation with the woman, I think, is remarkable. And I would hope that as we get into the other issues of Chile, that we'll have the same kind of recall.
Well, it was a very moving experience, Senator.
Well, some of the dates that I'm going to be going through, obviously not all in this round, are very profound issues. And I think I, in reading through the Church Committee report on what happened, was quite moved as well. The issue here is not so much Chile, because that's passed. 10 years have passed since then, as you pointed out to me yesterday. The question is, will the Reagan administration bring us back to the days when we tried to overthrow duly elected governments?
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that Allende got 36.4% of the vote. Under the Constitution, the issue is to be decided in the Congress, as you know. Do you think that what we did in Chile was in any way improper in trying to prevent Allende from taking power?
Well, first, as I have sensed from the earlier portion of our discussion and right till now, you are attempting to draw me into a very unfortunate position, which I do not think would be an accurate reflection of the role I played during the Chile period, and I hope to avoid that, Senator, for good and proper purposes.
Let me say that your capacity to deal with the senators that have questioned you is remarkable, and I'm sure you can do that very well.
Well, in an effort to try to do that, I would like to first, for the record, reiterate the position I placed in my annex with respect to the role I played in Chile at that time, since you seem to be so interested in it. Chile was not a special responsibility of mine, and I was not deeply involved in either overt or covert policies toward that country. In general, throughout my service on the National Security Council staff, I had no responsibility to review or approve any CIA covert activities in Chile. I'm aware that the Congress, and this is the pertinent part in response to your question, Senator, I'm aware that the Congress has established procedures for informing the Senate Intelligence Committee of all intelligence activities, including any significant anticipated intelligence activity. The Reagan administration, I know, intends to follow those procedures, and I personally intend to insist that we do so.
Before my time expires, could you answer the question as to whether you feel that anything we did in Chile in 1970 to prevent Allende, who was duly elected, from taking power, was at all improper?
Well, I would be not the fellow to give you a blanket answer to that. I was made aware, after the fact, by the Central Intelligence Agency of a failed kidnapped attempt against General Schneider, which resulted in his life. General Schneider was a man who I had followed over the years and had high regards for. I think that was a profound and unacceptable mistake. However, the Central Intelligence Agency also insisted and confirmed that they had not spawned that operation, although they had worked with the group that perpetrated it. And they were as appalled, at least in their reports to the White House, which I was made privy to, as were we.
The question is whether it was improper. Well, I'd simply say, Mr. Chairman, that I'm going to begin my next round with exactly the same question.
Thank you very much. Senator Kesselbaum.
Much as we would frequently like, I'm sure, definitive answers, specific answers to foreign policy issues, present and future, there is just not that comfort that I think we can afford at times regarding very complex foreign policy issues. And it would even be inappropriate as a future Secretary of State to give such answers. As the new chairman of the Foreign of the African Affairs Subcommittee of the Foreign Relations Committee, I would just like to commend you on the answer you gave this morning regarding the Namibia question, because as you, I'm sure, were very aware, there is a conference going on this week in Geneva, a very sensitive nature regarding the future of Namibia. And I think it was a very diplomatic answer. You touched on the question in a statement, I suppose, an observation in your opening statement regarding the increasing frustrations that we find in foreign policy decisions, advancing a position at the cost of one interest to the advantage of another interest of the United States. This seemingly leads us many times now to a paralysis of decision making. And I think an example that's presented to us today is the question of Somalia and Ethiopia. And I would like to ask you what you feel regarding the obvious need for the strategic advantage that a base at Berber would provide us versus the obvious cost of upsetting the colonial borders that are important to allies? Or is it necessary even to feel that there should be trade-offs?
Well, this is a very thoughtful question in its own right, Senator. I think most of us who've watched the changing strategic environment, not only in the Persian Gulf, but also in the Horn area of Africa itself, have been concerned by the growing Soviet presence along both littorals of the African continent and their ability with activities in Afghanistan and a successful outcome there for them and the uncertainties in Iran, that the lifelines of Western access to vital raw materials could very rapidly come under serious threat. Many have, and this current administration has looked at the importance and need to increasing the American presence in that area. And they've sought to gain access to a number of base rights, stretching far to the east to the island that we had some debate about here in town during my incumbency years ago, to Oman, and to the African continent itself, all designed to enhance American flexibility to react rapidly in the event the vital oil resources needed to this nation were threatened. And in general, I am comfortable with the current trend to accomplish that, to include the development and preparation of a rapid reaction force, which can be perceived and available for the American president and this committee, should it unfortunately become necessary to employ it. Now, with respect to particular locations for where American assets should be applied, I would like to speak somewhat greater time to study what progress has been made by this administration in a number of ongoing talks in these areas, and know what commitments they would entail for us in order to achieve these openings, and what the consequences would be. And one of the great problems of talking glibly about an American presence in the Persian Gulf area is that it could have precisely the opposite consequences that we are seeking. It could unite radical, so-called radical Arab states against us in a way that I think would be counterproductive.
And I think you will feel that there needn't necessarily be trade-offs, that the two wouldn't, interests wouldn't necessarily, one wouldn't co-opt the other, that...
This is the process of policymaking in which you have to lay out all of the implications, ramifications, parse them out, and hopefully arrive at the solution which best meets the vital interest of the American people.
I would like to ask briefly a question that was brought up this morning regarding the grain embargo, and you answered it partially in response to, I think, Senator Glenn's question. I would like to ask you, in the light of the fact that there's been some thought that there would be cabinet decision-making, and particularly a super cabinet created, how much would you, for instance, involve the Secretary of Agriculture in a decision regarding the grain embargo, and what weight would you give to his opinion?
Well, I have discussed this with the new Secretary of Agriculture designee. As you know, he had some earlier comments on this subject.
We all did.
I would like to make two points. First, I believe the Secretary of State must have the ability in matters of international agricultural trade, energy, technology transfer, to apply the litmus test of our political interest first and foremost before policies are pursued. This is fundamental. But I equally believe that when we establish policies with respect to agricultural affairs, that the Secretary of Agriculture must be a participant full-time with his full weight of concerns applied to that decision-making process. And that would be the way, I hope, and we're in the process of starting to do so now, our interdepartmental mechanisms would provide for this kind of interdepartmental consultation.
Well, I feel it's very important, and I'm pleased to hear you say that. How do you regard just embargoes generally, philosophically? Do you feel they have ever really been successful?
Well, I have a public record on this subject, and I have repeated it most recently. That is, as a general rule, I'm very suspicious of food embargoes. I think we have found in the past, and I know we did during my period in the NSC, that frequently we end up shooting ourselves in the foot. And by that I mean we end up selectively burdening one segment of our society or one segment of the Western community. And I'm more inclined to look first and foremost to be sure that before we institute that kind of a selective pressure, that we have unanimity among our allies and the other grain-producing or whatever the commodity-producing, technology-producing nations would be, so that we will have a consistent front, and also hopefully to broaden the character of the application of these pressures to include not just food, but a host of other interfaces.
Right. I only have a minute or so, but would you feel the same way about economic sanctions?
Well, I think yes. I think we have to be very careful to the degree we can, and we're not always imbued with that luxury to try to share the burdens of these problems and not to single out one segment of our society. And above all, to be sure that those of us that are engaged in it are equally burdened, and I mean that in a multilateral sense, internationally.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kestrel. Senator Cranston?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I welcome you before this committee, General. As I told you yesterday, it is my hope that these hearings will establish a basis for the Senate and the American people to achieve full confidence in you if, as of course is most likely, you are confirmed as our Secretary of State. This full sense of confidence would be in the national interest and in your own interest if you were to be the effective Secretary of State that we all hope you can be. You are, as several senators have noted in preceding me today, a man of demonstrated abilities and achievements. I have a keen interest in learning how you would use these remarkable abilities and the unique background that you have acquired, first of all, to address what I believe is the most important task confronting the incoming Reagan administration, the need to prevent U.S.-Soviet competition from escalating into a nuclear confrontation, whether by design or by inadvertency. Full-scale nuclear war between us would destroy our security and all that we value and seek to defend. It would be the ultimate catastrophe, the ultimate human holocaust. At the same time, I share with you the belief that what we value and seek to defend is even more important than life itself. The question is, how do we prevent that U.S.-Soviet competition from escalating into nuclear confrontation, either through design or inadvertence? Certainly we must, we both agree, upgrade our nuclear and conventional capabilities to reduce the danger that adversaries might underestimate our strength and our resolve to defend our freedom and our security. I trust you agree also that we must match this military effort with effective diplomacy to protect our interests, to promote democratic development around the world, and to address global issues which threaten our future, issues like poverty and overpopulation. I want to be sure that I understand your answer to Senator Baker's question on the dangers of nuclear war. Did you mean that we run a greater risk of nuclear war, that we undermine the credibility of our deterrence, if we indicate any lack of will to undergo that ordeal, if necessary, to preserve our freedoms? In other words, General, if we lead our adversaries to believe and to act on the assumption that we value our lives more than our liberties, will we be increasing the danger of nuclear war?
I want to be sure I have the connotation of your question, Senator. As I recast it, I think what you're asking me is, do I perceive that international stability and peace are better preserved by projecting an image to potential adversaries, and in this instance the Soviet Union, that we are indeed prepared to employ the weapons that we are building, than to suggest to them that a nuclear exchange outcome would be an outcome that would be unacceptable to us under any set of circumstances?
Yes, that is what I meant. And in effect, do you thus mean that by taking that stance, we reduce the dangers significantly that we will actually ever find ourselves in the catastrophe of nuclear war?
Yes, and I think you have to be very careful of cryptic, compressed, glib answers to a question of that profound nature. But I think you have to get to it to get to the essence of what deterrence is all about. Because after all, I don't think there's anybody in this room, at least of all me, who would come up here and present a rationale which was flirting with the desirability of getting into a nuclear conflict. It would be a disaster. But the problem is how do you get there? And that's here where differences exist between very well-meaning, thoughtful people. And I would suggest my reading of history, my experience in the international community, suggests to me that our deterrent achieves its credibility by the perception of our willingness to do whatever is necessary to protect our vital interests. If they are challenged, then that must include the arsenal of nuclear weapons that we maintain at such great cost today. It does not mean, in any sense, that someone that harbors that view, and I happen to think it's the right one, is a proponent for nuclear warfare or for destabilization.
That is what I thought you meant. I concur in your judgment. Do you believe that there is any acceptable alternative to the determined, steadfast pursuit of balanced, verifiable nuclear arms control agreements if our long-term security interests are to be advanced?
Here again, I think a glib answer could get you into deep trouble. I would want to make it very clear that I've always been a proponent for arms control, and especially efforts to get the nuclear genie back into the bottle, that is, minimize the level of nuclear weapons, minimize nuclear proliferation. But if that becomes the end in itself, and it is sought at the expense of other vital national interests, we may end up with a process in which we put it itself in jeopardy, the process you're seeking. I believe these are very important, vitally important objectives for the United States. But they must also and always be pursued as ancillaries to our own vital national interests first and foremost. For example, I've always believed that we acquire breakthroughs in negotiations with the Soviet Union in arms control only when they perceive the alternative facing them as a willingness on the part of the United States to match or better what they are willing to deploy. Why in heaven's name should they sit down and negotiate limitations with us if we're going to do it to ourselves without such negotiations?
You've stated that the United States should only agree to arms limitation agreements which are in our interest, and of course nobody would quarrel with that. You go on to link United States support for such agreements to other aspects of the U.S.-Soviet competition. Is there any reason for the U.S. to forego any nuclear arms control agreement that is clearly in our strategic interest?
Well, again, that's a very narrowly banded question, I suspect it's leading me into a trap that you've been carefully laying for me. I do not want to suggest to you that we should be in the business of scrubbing existing agreements. Not at all. The worst thing we can do as a nation, and I said that in my opening statement, is to project an image of unreliability or inconsistency. Where we've made obligations, we must live by them. Unless the terms of those obligations provide for escape clauses because of abrogation by the other partner. I hope that's the answer to your question. I'm not sure that it is.
Well, I was, first of all, not thinking of any traps. I have none in mind.
Yeah.
I was thinking really prospectively more than to the present terms of SALT I and SALT II that we mutually still adhere to. I was thinking of the effort to achieve further agreements like those that might ultimately lead to reductions. As you indicated this morning, you and the President feel would be desirable.
I was wondering, in light of the fact that we may be getting involved in the issue of subpoenas either later today or tomorrow at some point, if we might shortcut that process by you requesting of former President Nixon if he would be willing to consent to the release of these presidential materials so that we might have direct access to them without going through the legal proceedings of subpoenas. Or maybe you have already asked them, in light of your statements and comments earlier this morning, which I applaud, by the way, of your desire that this committee have every bit of information it should have in order to reach its decision.
No, I didn't ask them, Senator, but you know, since this question has specifically arisen, I think it would be awfully important for the committee to know what period we are talking about with respect to these tapes. I came to the White House on the 8th of May of 1973, having served for a period of about 4 to 6 months as Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, and during the period preceding that, having been working intensely in the area of negotiating our Vietnamese peace treaty, to include trips to Paris and Saigon and back repeatedly. Now, when I arrived at the White House on the 8th of May, I hardly even knew the details of Watergate. Shortly after my arrival, I learned there was a taping system that one even existed. But I thought that it was a manipulated taping system of the kind President Johnson, and I believe President Kennedy had. I know President Johnson had. I learned at the same time the Senate Investigating Committee learned that it was a voice-activated system. And on that very day, I ordered it dismantled. It was, despite what you may read in some books by certain experts. Now, we are talking about a period of, from May 8th, a good portion of which the President was away and in Florida, to the period of, I think, about the 13th or 14th of July, at a time when I didn't even know the details of Watergate. Now, I just want to be sure the committee understands this issue. There were no tape recordings following that period. There were no tape recordings covering the period that seems to titillate so many people about my advice or non-advice to President Nixon. But I think it's important. Sometimes we forget that as we struggle on issues. Now, I cannot presume for myself to deal with this issue. I think this is a problem for this committee and a problem for lawyers, especially within this committee, because I know for a fact Mr. Nixon's been litigating this issue at great expense to himself for a number of years. Now, I can't presume to interpose myself in it. It's not my position to do so.
General,
but I can assure you I have no reservations whatsoever about what may or may not have been on those tapes.
I know you've stated that, and I appreciate that statement. I think that's commendable. And as all I'm suggesting, and I'm not tilting...
Well, it's a fundamental issue. I'm here under oath, and if we are dealing with that kind of a problem, then best we know it, and early on.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily, for my part, I certainly am not about to speak for anyone else on this committee. It just seemed to me we're talking about a primary body of evidence which could shed some light, that's all, on that issue, not the issue of Watergate per se. And it just occurred to me that I know how strongly President Nixon feels about your appointment, and understandably so, given your record. And it just occurred to me that he might be willing, in light of this committee's desire to expedite the process, to assist us in that effort. That's all.
Well, sir, I'm just not going to interpose myself in this question because there are a number of other issues associated with it.
So I would...
In terms of completing these hearings in a responsible time.
So as in response to my inquiry, your answer would be that you would not make that inquiry up?
No, I won't interpose myself in an issue of that importance.
Let me, if I can... Senator Zirinsky asked you about the Panama Canal treaties. And you indicated that you would support those treaties are now the law of the land, and as such, you would support them. You had some questions about them. You went back to, I think, Senator Kennedy's administration, where you had some experience in dealing with those treaties. Oftentimes on the floor of the House or the Senate, amendments are offered that will tend to undermine certain obligations in this country, usually having to do with the appropriations process. May I ask of you, in light of your earlier statement about your support for these treaties, whether or not you will aggressively oppose efforts that would undermine the Panama Canal Treaty specifically?
I hope I didn't leave you with the impression that I'd made a value judgment at all on the Panama Canal Treaty. I thought I avoided doing so, other than to say that we have this treaty and we certainly must support it.
Well, my question is, oftentimes we find that there are those members who oppose certain treaties, certain obligations, and they will offer amendments on the floor or in committee, which will, in effect, obviate those responsibilities by wiping out the appropriations for it.
Oh, well, you see, that's what concerned me, because you had concluded that I made a value judgment on the treaty itself, therefore would proceed with certain actions in the light of that value judgment. I hope I didn't, and by answering that question, then I have to make that value judgment, which I prefer to avoid. You know, I don't disagree with what was said here this morning. I made the point that these negotiations, I believe, at least conceptually, started during the Kennedy administration. They were conducted beyond that into the Johnson years. I think I recall President Nixon suggesting we put it on the back burner. Subsequently, it was revitalized by President Ford. And yeah, it's true. There's a long historic tail to this issue. And we're there. And I'd like to keep myself as one who supports the fact that we are there and intend to maintain that support.
Let me just ask you one quick question while the yellow light is on. You may be able to answer quickly. We are presently have committed some $70 or $75 million to the new government in Nicaragua. Have you drawn any conclusions at all about whether or not we ought to continue that commitment?
No, I haven't, Senator. I make no bones about the concerns I had along the way as we got to